and for being right here with us every single weekday, 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. Today, it's the Fresno State kickoff dinner. So if you did not get your Fresno State kickoff dinner tickets, that's completely okay. You can still go and buy season tickets on GoBulldogs.com. You can still be a part of everything. But Fresno State kickoff dinner is tonight live from Table Mountain Casino. And should be a lot of fun. Fresno State women's soccer got going yesterday. To say the least, it didn't go the way they wanted to. 2-0 loss to UC Davis, a game where Hayden was right. It was a physical game. And the Bulldogs, I think, held up defensively for quite a bit of time. And just a couple of moments in that game went UC Davis's way. They went 2-0 over the Bulldogs in their season and home opener. For Fresno State, as again, they took on the Aggies yesterday at Fresno State Soccer Stadium. The National League is in a tight race. It is about four teams, and the rest are, I think, just going to be close. They're just going to be close. The Milwaukee Brewers have now lost three in a row, losing three of getting swept, by the way, by the San Diego Padres. Brewers losing 3-2, 11-2, and 4-3 in the series for the Brewers and the Padres. A Brewers team that is now going to face a Dodger team in a four-game set. Tomorrow, it'll be on MLB TV. On Saturday on Fox, and on Sunday on MLB TV as well. So these are going to be some fun games for the Brewers and the Dodgers. But the Brewers are coming into this not in the best of ways. They had won 2 of 3 against the Minnesota Twins before, and that is over the past weekend, before this series against Padres, but getting swept by the Padres, which also then helped the Padres get to a 5-game winning streak. And now sitting on top of the Arizona Diamondbacks, a game in front of the Diamondbacks are the Padres. So now Padres second in the division, sitting 8.5 games back of the Los Angeles Dodgers. Milwaukee, again, in first in the National League, a game in front of the Atlanta Braves, who are 73-48. And the Los Angeles Dodgers, who are 73-48. So the Milwaukee Brewers, 3-game sweep, getting swept. The Atlanta Braves, on the other hand, well, after getting a series opening loss by the New York Mets after losing in the series opener, 8-5, the Braves then turned it around, won 4-0, 6-3 in the next two games, winning 2 of 3 against the Mets. Now the Atlanta Braves over the weekend, they have an off day today, but over the weekend they will take on the Arizona Diamondbacks. And the Arizona Diamondbacks, who are 64-58. This game is in Atlanta, or this series in Atlanta. The Dodgers, well, they come off a 3-game sweep of the Kansas City Royals after struggling, and I mean struggling, after getting swept by the Red Sox and getting swept by the Cubbies. The Diamondbacks winning 2 of 3 against LA. The Dodgers have found their winning ways again. Not in a dominating fashion either. They won 6-5 in the first game of the series, with Ohtani hitting a go-ahead home run, scoring a go-ahead run in the seventh, a game in which the Royals led early 3-0. Dodgers were able to come back in that, and the bottom of the seventh inning, Freeman bringing in Ohtani in that. Skubal was the pitcher in that game for the Dodgers, giving up 3 runs in 5 innings on 4 hits. The Dodgers win it, though. Then 4-5 extras, they were able to win in extras against the Royals, a game in which the Royals were leading after the top of the eighth inning, scoring 3 runs. having a lead there. Dodgers were able to tie it in the bottom of the frame and then win it in the 10th inning. They then beat the Royals again 4-2. And this Royal team, who falls to 49-73 on the season, the Dodgers able to sweep them. It doesn't matter how close the games are. It doesn't matter if the Dodgers deserved any of those games. What matters is winning, and the Dodgers did exactly that. A four-game set against the Brewers is a setup for Los Angeles. Tonight at 7:10, Rokai Sasaki is going to take on Shane Drun. And that is tonight at 7:10. Then tomorrow on Friday night, you have Yonoshibo Yamamoto taking on Robert Gasser. Just pitching matchup alone seems like a tilt one way. And then Jacob the Miz Mizorowski, he is on the mound against Justin Robleski. And that is on the Saturday ledger. And then on Sunday, you will have Logan Henderson take on Tarek Skubal on Sunday in what could be a very decisive game in this one. Then the Dodgers will have the Rockies and the Pirates after that. They will have a series coming up at the end of August against the Atlanta Braves in Atlanta. The Cubs, they started a series on Tuesday. They have won 2 of 3 so far over the Washington Nationals, 8-6, 12-6. They come off a weekend 2 of 3 against Kansas City. And obviously, as mentioned, they had that Dodgers series in which they swept the Dodgers in 3 games. Now, to that, and talking about that, we look at the standings again. And if you are looking at the National League, the Cubs are just sitting 2 games back of the Dodgers and the Braves. But, hey, that doesn't matter if they are not the division leader, because they are sitting 3 games back of the National League Central leader in the Milwaukee Brewers. The Cubs sitting 3 games back there. Again, the Padres could be beginning to fire on all cylinders. And they swept the Brewers. They have a series coming up this week. On the road on Friday against the Cleveland Guardians, a 3-game set there. The Padres able to take 2 of 3 against the Astros last weekend. It is going to be on San Diego to see if they are going to be able to actually continue to take up some space on that game's back. I don't think they are. I think that they are getting nice and warm. I don't see them getting hot. They have a +1 in run differential, 522 runs scored and 521 runs against. So this team has very, very much acted like a 500 team, has acted like a team that does not deserve the thought that they would catch the Dodgers. I am still not there yet. Arizona, Philly, Miami all followed them. In the American League, the worst 2 records in the American League belong to the AL West. The 2 worst records in the National League belong to the NL West. The Colorado Rockies and the Giants have the 2 worst records in the National League. The 2 worst records in baseball are the Angels and the Athletics. And the Athletics are having lost 3 consecutive games. Also in the American League West, the Seattle Mariners have now lost 6 in a row. 6 in a row. While everything seemed to be beginning to go everyone's way in the American League East, well, the Tampa Bay Rays say, hold on a minute, and they have now won 9 in a row. They have seen the Boston Red Sox winning streak and said, I raise you one of my own. They swept the Seattle Mariners in 3. They swept the Athletics in 3, and they swept the Colorado Rockies in 3 as well. Their last loss, the Tampa Bay Rays, was August 2nd against the Chicago White Sox. So Tampa Bay now with a 6-game lead over the New York Yankees and a 10-game lead over the Boston Red Sox. The Yankees The Red Sox, who after going on all of these winning streaks and after Phil Bonatti was telling me how they were going to win a World Series, and I was starting to believe him. They lost 2 of 3 to the Athletics over the weekend. They then had a 3-game set. Today is going to make it a 4-game set. Pardon me. They are on a 4-game set against the Blue Jays, and the Red Sox have lost all 3 games so far of that 4-game set. A loss tonight or this afternoon, games at noon. If the Red Sox lose today, they would have gotten swept in back-to-back series following such a long winning streak, eliminating every ounce of their climb back with this back-to-back series here. But again, 3 of 4 so far have lost by the Red Sox, and a loss tonight or this afternoon will result in back-to-back sweeps, but that means getting swept. The Red Sox there. They're now 10 games back of the Tampa Bay Rays, but the 3 best records in the American League all come out of the American League East. The Central, just sitting 5 games above .500 are the White Sox. 2 games above .500 are the Houston Astros. Those are the other two division leaders. Currently, the playoffs, getting in on the wild card would be the Yankees, Red Sox, and the Texas Rangers. In the National League, the 3 teams in right now are the Chicago Cubs, the San Diego Padres, and a tie between the Arizona Diamondbacks and the Philadelphia Phillies. So there you have it on there as well. So that's where Major League Baseball stands. That is where the playoffs currently stand. I am standing 10 toes down at the Atlanta Braves. I think are going to be the team to watch in the National League to be able to take on the Los Angeles Dodgers, who I think clearly are going to be one of the best teams, and I think clearly are going to be one of the teams at near the end there in the National League. In the American League, it seems like it's Tampa, and more Tampa. The New York Yankees are awaiting that return to form for Aaron Judge, who seemingly, when he is not in that lineup, the Yankees are a completely different team than when he is in that lineup, and it is drastic for my eyes, and I'm sure drastic for your eyes as well. So there you go. Those are your Major League Baseball updates as we look around the league. We don't have anything else to really dive into right now. There's still more to come in terms of the baseball conversation. So there you go. Take a break. We'll be back. You are listening to the Valley Rise Show with Gonzo on your local sports leader, ESPN Fresno. San Francisco 49ers begin their preseason today against the Tennessee Titans, and well, that is going to be, it's the beginning of the football season officially for the San Francisco 49ers, and one of the things that I'm really interested to see is Deshaun Stripling, and whether what we have seen in practice and the success so far that he has shown in practice is going to translate to the football field in terms of game time. He's been one of the stories of training camp. He had missed about a week due to a hamstring issue, but he was definitely one of the standouts in team joint practices with the Tennessee Titans. And now everybody's kind of just waiting to see if that is going to translate to the game setting. Now, one of the keys for him is going to be whether he actually understands this offense, where he actually gets this offense, and whether or not the San Francisco 49ers are going to be able to get him involved, get him the ball, especially because of what Mike Evans is, right? Because of what we know Deebo Samuel is. And so we have to continuously hope that one of these young guys, especially with the decision, obviously, for surgery, I I'm going to be interested. Just interested to see if Deshaun Stribling is going to be that guy today. Again, tonight for the San Francisco 49ers over the Tennessee Titans. Robert Jones will probably get the start after running with the first team for the past week. And, well, what is going on at left guard for the San Francisco 49ers? Front runner to start at left guard, Connor Colby and rookie Carver Willis should also see time at the spot. And the order they're inserted could definitely be telling in terms of who will be up next if Jones doesn't woo the coaching staff, which there is a chance that very much does happen. Nick Bosa is dealing with knee tendonitis, and it wouldn't be a surprise if Osa sits out. That leaves the door open for a variety of different players to see the field without the two biggest stars on the field. And we'll see if the pass rush is absent in today's game. That's going to be a huge problem, knowing that, hey, behind those two guys, there's not a lot there. And also, 49ers will be without their tight end, George Kittle. Jake Tungis was the guy that they turned to while Kittle was injured last season. But if he misses a week or two, the 49ers tight ends have shown in camp they can provide enough pass catching to help the team moving forward. Fred Warner and Dre Greenlaw are more than likely not going to play tonight. If Nick Martin plays, it will be interesting to see whether he lines up at the Sam or Will linebacker spots. He's probably a Will linebacker long term, but this season he could be the 49ers' best option at the Sam position. Rookie Jaden Duggar is another player to watch. He has a skill set to line up at linebacker, seeing how they will use him as well. There are a list of players not playing and wind up being the most important thing to take away. Any healthy player who doesn't suit up is more than likely in line for a significant role and has done enough in practice that the 49ers coaching staff doesn't feel the need for them to play in a game scenario. Warner, Trent Williams, Brock Purdy, all very obvious choices to sit. What will be interesting is on whether a rookie like Stribling or an unestablished a second-year player like Martin gets the night off. If they do, it bodes very well from them going into the regular season. So some of the question marks on the San Francisco 49ers going into this. Just as we look at it, Connor Colby has to have himself a showing tonight. If he does not, it is going to start questioning everything as to what the 49ers are going to do at left guard. Robert Jones, also an offensive lineman, his same logic applies here. He needs to take advantage of opportunities given to him. Jack Jones, a cornerback. Renardo Green as the starter. But Jack Jones has been making a strong case to potentially bring Renardo Green down from that starting position. A strong performance against the Titans won't allow him to supplement Green as a starter, but it definitely is going to give them a real look. Jordan Watkins, he hasn't been cited much during this preseason. He's not doing a whole lot to stand out in the training camp session, though he has been playing with the second and third stringers, and maybe he's better suited to make that flashy kind of play. Watkins is buried on the depth chart, but if he goes out there and balls out, the coaches will nod definitely to give him a potential more of an opportunity here in the upcoming season. So the San Francisco 49ers and the Tennessee Titans go toe-to-toe tonight in a preseason matchup. The Las Vegas Raiders, they also play today, a 5 p.m. kick against the Arizona Cardinals. The Raiders, who have not been absent of a lot of the conversation surrounding the quarterback competition. And well, today we'll get a very good grasp as to how this is going to handle. How will the Las Vegas Raiders handle Fernando Mendoza during the preseason as well is definitely another big question mark for the Las Vegas Raiders. And that is where all eyes are going to be. All eyes are going to be on Fernando Mendoza. It's easy. It's clear. We all know we want to see whether the quarterback is going to have a real chance at potentially winning the job this year, or if this is a certainty, if it is a certainty that this is a Kirk Cousins team this year, maybe most of the season, maybe not all of it, but at least at the beginning of it, could be something that the Raiders make a decision on and do. So interested to see on that front there. So preseason football, it's right here and it is here. You'll be able to listen to, by the way, to the Raiders preseason game on 790 ESPN Fresno. You'll be able to listen to the Fresno Grizzlies right here on 1430 ESPN. So later tonight, the Grizzlies on your airwaves right here on your local sports leader, and the Raiders will be on your airwaves on ESPN Fresno on 790 AM. So if you want to listen to both, you definitely can. Okay. So, it is Thursday. We like doing our conversation of the week on Thursdays because Fridays, you know, we got our guy Gus, and he joins us for an hour, and we're able to kind of go A to Z with him. But Thursdays, we don't have a weekly standing guest, and that lets us have one of the discussions you might have missed. I talked to Gabe Camarillo on Monday. Here is part of that conversation. Looking at the football field.
Where is the quarterback competition at, Gabe?
Because I think Martin looks really good. I've taken some notes from what I've watched the past week, and
yeah,
I wrote down Martin's ball is about half second quicker on an out route than Jaden Mandel's. It's just his ball's so tight. Yesterday or what was it? Saturday? It must have been Saturday. Just watching him throw, it just looks crisper than any other quarterbacks. And Martin's the bigger quarterback. He looks athletic. I don't want to say he's the more athletic quarterback because we hardly get to see much at these practices. Just them throwing on air,
yeah.
You know, contactless receiver drills. It's interesting because I'm also looking at the receivers, and there's a lot of good looking receivers, and that's good because, well, they want to expand the passing game. And so I think that's going to factor into the decision too, which quarterback throws the best deep ball. Right now, from what I see, Christian Martin and Deegan Rose, they are throwing the best deep ball in practice. And I'm talking about how tight the spiral is, where it's at on the receiver's body, if it's leading the receiver, if the receiver has to stop in his tracks to catch it. I'm looking at all these things. And it's just consistency from Martin, and I'm starting to see it from Deegan Rose too. So, I mean, Jaden Mandel, he doesn't look bad. It's just I really think Rose and Martin are talented, like really talented. Martin obviously has way more experience being through a college program like Maryland. I just see whoever's the quarterback, I see a growing curve, a learning curve, because obviously they haven't played. I looked at Pro Football Focus a couple of days ago. Career snaps wise, like how many snaps these guys have taken and dropped back and passed, combined 33 snaps for these two quarterbacks who were backups at their previous schools, Mandel's still at his previous school. He hasn't moved.
Yeah.
But the point is, like, despite the inexperience, Martin's physical tools are making themselves very apparent. It's just a matter of when he will mentally be able to catch up as a Division I starting quarterback, because there's always a growing curve, and it's going to be a steep growing curve when you play against the top 15 team in the country on the road.
So wide receiver Freeman was asked about it, and yeah. He's like, hey, man, both of these quarterbacks are playing like they want it and playing really – really well. And so it's going to be the little things that push one in front of the other. And again, the competition that we were told is between Christian Martin and Mandel. Jaden Mandel.
Right. But I'm saying Deegan Rose looks really good.
And I was going to go to your point because during the media day, Coach Davis made it a point in his interview with Paul Leffler and Phil Bonatti. He said it on there. He said we're comfortable with both quarterbacks, Martin and with Mandel being leading into this. He said, we think we can win a championship with both. That's almost a dang near quote. Uh-huh. The second thing was he went out of his way to make sure to talk about Deegan. And how he was ahead in the mental space than he thought he was with an early signee and enrollee. That's a good sign. Like, for me, as someone who can't wait and hopefully can see a Deegan Rose being a quarterback at Fresno State and having a local guy lead, and that's why, again, Mandel does have a little piece of that in me where I'm like, I would love to enjoy to see a local kid be a quarterback. Now, I want Fresno State to win. So regardless of that, I want the best player to get the job. But talking about a Martin, is the benefit of this quarterback competition that Fresno State wants to run the football, then throw the football effectively? Is that a really big positive? Because I don't think the game is going to be put on your shoulders as a quarterback. You're going to be put in a position to say, hey, just make the right decisions. Just follow the protocol, like follow the plays, follow the protocols, and we'll be put in a position to be successful.
It depends what you have at quarterback. Fresno State leaned heavily on the run last year, in part because they really couldn't trust the quarterbacks they had last year. I mean, they saw it against Oregon State with the turnovers that E.J. Warner had. I mean, even in the Kansas game, that was not a good start to the year. But then we see last year how limited the quarterbacks are in terms of throwing downfield. There were hardly any passes thrown further than 20, 25 yards down the field. Everything was within 20 yards, and then even there were some issues with keeping the football. And so it's different now because I think the skill sets for both quarterbacks who are competing for the starting job are similar but much different than last year's quarterbacks. So Mandel and Martin, both very mobile. And you couldn't really say that about Conklin or Warner. I know Warner tried his best to run. He did a decent job at it, but he wasn't a runner. He was a pocket passer. Whereas I could see Mandel and Martin qualifying as dual threat because I could see both guys picking up first downs on a 3rd and 4 with their legs or scoring a touchdown on a goal line situation on a run play. You know, if a play's broken, I could see either of them extending it with their legs. So having that element of the quarterback play is groundbreaking because I think about other guys who did that, Marcus McMarion. I don't know why Chasen Virgil came in my head. That's not a good example at all. But that's another guy who was a mobile quarterback for the Bulldogs.
It was very mobile.
So Chasen Virgil, okay, Marcus McMarion. Yes, like that's a great example of a mobile quarterback. That's similar to what the Bulldogs have with Martin and Mandel.
Even a Jake Haener moved. He wasn't mobile,
but
he moved.
He was like E.J. Warner. Yeah, he could move, but he was a pocket.
He did a lot better than most pocket passers. Like, he got out of there, and he would take a hit. And it was one of the more things. Like, there were things that I didn't like of Jake Haener, but his toughness to decide to attack.
His arm, man. I'll never stop raving about his arm. That was, I think, just as up there as Derek Carr's. Not as strong as Derek Carr's, because Carr made a career off his strong arm, and Haener couldn't. But I'm telling you, like, Haener's throws, especially like in the Rose Bowl, that's one example, but there's a lot of throws he made. I think like the touchdown to Zane Pope in the championship, that's another one that I think of. But yeah, I mean, we can talk about past quarterbacks, the current and future quarterback of the Fresno State Bulldogs. If you're asking me what I see at practice, Martin is impressing with his leadership and his physical attributes. I think Mandel, where he can win this battle is by being there longer and knowing the offense more because he's seen it more. And he saw it last year. And I really wonder what would have happened if he never got injured last year, because that was his opportunity last year, I think, with Conklin and Warner both struggling. Mandel could have easily come in and made his case on the field in live action that he could be the starting quarterback this year. But he didn't get that opportunity. He kind of started at the same time as Martin this spring. And so obviously, Mandel's been in the offense longer, but since they started competing in spring ball, I feel like Martin has consistently proven that he can pick up the playbook and he has the physical tools to where if they have to go out of the playbook and go off script, he can make things happen.
We're talking with Gabe Camarillo, Fox 26 KMPH, and kind of veering off of the quarterbacks, because obviously that's going to be the biggest point of conversation here for the upcoming season, which again, September 4th against USC is getting closer and closer. It is going to, we're going to blink and it's going to be here. A Friday game. So let's look at that running back room. It was announced Brandon Ramirez last week. Official. I think most of us kind of knew coming out of spring camp, but He's gone for the rest of the year. Who is filling that role as third back, heavy back? The guy who likes to bounce off of tackles or just likes tackles?
Could be up for a battle. I brought up two guys on Twitter, Tariq Thomas, a Bucknell transfer, and Julius Gillick last year in the bowl game. Kind of had a coming out party a little bit, got more touches. He had the Brandon Ramirez type touches, but I think Ramirez played in the bowl game too. I think they were trying to rest Donaldson and Luke in that game. But yeah, Donaldson and Luke obviously will have a huge role this year. I think Donaldson grew out his hair a bit, and he's starting to remind me what he looked like when he was at CVC. Mm. I'm just thinking like Ricky Williams type of hairdo, and I hope he runs like Ricky too. That's kind of like his NFL comp, if I had to compare him to somebody, like the physical but speedy running back who, when he's healthy, man, he can go. And Donaldson, that's a huge X factor for this season. Speedy Luke, we know that he's going to average like 5 to 6 yards a carry and probably rip a 50-yard run once every 2 weeks or maybe once every week if he's really feeling it this year. That's what he did last year. But I don't want to put expectations on a guy like that. Speedy has a lot of expectations, though. Donaldson does. Besides those two, I mean, yeah, it's kind of unproven territory. Gillick had some time, but not a lot. The coaches rave about him, though.
I was going to say, I've been hearing nothing but amazing things about
Gillick. Think of like Josh Hokett as a running back, just somebody who's a bowling ball, bounces off tacklers, kind of exactly what you're referencing when you say Brandon Ramirez. But Tariq Thomas, he just has the look about him, like, and he has the resume too. Look up his stats. His stats at Bucknell were insane. And Bucknell's the type of school that I feel like it's not that hard to make a jump from Division II and FCS territory to FBS Pac-12 play. We've seen a lot of guys do it at Fresno State. Jacob Spomer was a good example of a guy who made the right jump from mid-level program to a Division I program like Fresno State. So that's offensive line-wise. Running back-wise, I don't know the last time we've seen somebody like this who can come in from a Division II FCS school and potentially play right away like Tariq Thomas. It's very competitive there. And I should also mention Dadis Lucky has seen a lot of snaps in fall camp. He's a freshman. So there's good competition in there. It's just a shame because obviously Brandon Ramirez is local. And we saw him do well what he did last year. He was a good short yardage back who really emphasizes and embodies toughness wins because it's tough to tackle that dude.
A lot. We're talking to Gabe Camarillo, Fox 26 KMPH. And Gabe, a lot was talked about the defensive line last week.
Yeah.
They actually, some of the players made a point to mention the D-line. Harris mentioned it. He almost called it the best group so far in camp. He stopped. He made sure not to say it. But he was close to saying it. So what are you hearing coming from that defensive line? And is obviously getting to the quarterback is going to be a huge deal because last year takeaways were the question of can we increase that? Can we increase the amount of opportunities for the offense to go and get us some points? Defensive line is a critical portion of that because if you create pressure, you create mistakes.
I love that they have a complete defensive line that's coming back from last year. There's obviously the missing parts of Finn Claypool. And I think even there at the edge rusher position where you lost Claypool, Jazon Jacks is coming back for his fifth year. Guy who played with Jake Haener, who we just talked about in 2022, a true veteran of the team. And he wants to be more of a threat as a pass rusher this year. He's always been good at stopping the run off the edge. But getting to the quarterback, as you said, is so imperative. I asked him, you know, have you talked about or have you discussed this offseason trying to figure out how to become more of a David Perales? Remember David Perales a few years ago, a dude who was just a wrecker off the edge and was a huge part of that championship team? And he talked about, yeah, getting to the quarterback is one thing, but obviously the stats, you can't look at sacks with this defensive line because of how Nick Benedetto schemes. It's all meant to make the quarterback do a terrible thing. Like, that's the whole scheme for Benedetto. Put the quarterback in a terrible position where he has to make a bad choice. And that means pass rushing. That means putting pressure. And so you see a lot of pressures from the front four. I'm thinking Jazon Jacks with a lot of experience. Sonny Zepra, Dejon Lafitte, Sienna Noah, another veteran of the defensive line. I know I'm forgetting somebody, but just there's so much coming back from last year. It's very impressive to see them be truly too deep at this position. And they're going to have to rotate guys to keep him happy, to keep him fed. You got to give the guy snaps to make him go. And it's a deep defensive line for sure.
Because one of the things that obviously paints into this is when you get a coach that gets a year two, a year three, and the guys begin to understand the system and guys get to start teaching other guys, right? Like the most difficult part about being a first year or being in your first year at a university is that you don't have, unless you get transfer, and that's why it's important to bring transfer with you, right? Yeah. But if you don't get the guys who already know your system, you're teaching everyone from scratch. In that teaching everyone from scratch, there's not that one leader and player that can go in your group that can go, okay, what he is wants us to do here is this. Hey, what he really is saying is this. Guys who just kind of understand the verbiage of a coach and what the coach is really looking for. You got that this year. Like, you got guys that understand, okay, this is what he was looking for last year. As you mentioned it, and I said it, pressure makes mistakes, right? And the idea here is how often are you sending extra pressure? How often are you only relying on that front line to go and create pressure? Because if you're able to sit a couple more back in coverage,
yeah,
that's where you get those INTs. That's where you get those deflections and all.
And Fresno State has so many guys in the back seven that can make a play on the ball. Even the linebackers, like Thunderbird, he had a 60-yard pick six last year against Hawaii. Kajabi is athletic enough and nimble enough. He played wide receiver, I think, in high school. Played tight end in high school.
Tight end,
so
yeah.
He is very very athletic. And then, obviously, the defensive backs. That's kind of the question mark area. We're hearing Truly Bell, Loyal Muzan. I love these names for the corners. Truly, Loyal. Like, these are dependable guys just by their first name alone. But not only that, like, the safeties, right? Ryan Wilson, a fifth-year guy, back there patrolling it. I like seeing the experience in the secondary where you're losing guys like Cameron Brock or Azilian or Jakari. You know, we got to stop saying these names because they're not here this year. We got to start coming up with these new guys with not as much experience. Another name I should mention, Keontre Harris from Lemoore. That's a name and a game that I really like a lot of. I saw him in high school. That's the last time I saw him play. But just I remember how tall and athletic he was and how he matched up well with the receivers at Clovis West at the time, Marshall Sanders, Landon Wright, JoJo Piero, like he was able to cover those guys and hang with them. They almost beat Clovis West that year. So it's good to see the Lemoore product in the mix in the secondary. But yeah, that's why what works in the front four is not necessarily getting sacks or getting TFLs on every play, but consistently applying the pressure. And another name I mentioned or should have mentioned and didn't, Martin Owusu. Played every game and started every game, all nine of them, before we got injured at D-tackle. But then you know what they were able to do when he got injured at D-tackle? Throw in another guy, Sione Noah. Logan Goodspeed, too. He can play inside and outside. There's just so much experience from last year and guys who are truly gritty, put your fingers in the dirt and just attack the quarterback. Considering the strong offensive line play that we'll see in the Pac-12, at least with Boise and Washington State, I think those two lines and Texas State too, throw them in there. It's going to be good to see us combat that with, or I said us, Fresno State combat that with a good defensive line. I'm going to lump, so it's still a habit I'm trying to break.
I don't have to break that habit. As a sports radio host, I'm going to show my allegiance every single day. We're talking to Gabe Camarillo. He's a TV guy, so he has to have some sort of
impartiality. Yeah.
Fox 26 KMPH. And so, Gabe, just straying away a little. Final thing that I wanted to say on the Fresno State side is just, it's the intensity. We're seeing it constantly. It's the want to be great, and that is what excites me about the season. But one thing that you're going to hear me tell you again, and we're going to talk about this again then, will be how important it is for a great showing against USC just because of the fandom. Just because of the fans.
Yeah, and we're going to go back to that. There's a steep learning curve, though. Like the quarterback play, I don't know how good they're going to play in that first game against a top 15 team. And USC, who if they lose that game, Lincoln Riley's cooked.
Yeah, don't get me wrong. Don't get me wrong. I am not saying that Fresno State should walk in there and should leave with a win. I'm saying the fans, because of the build of this game, because of who it is, if we don't have a good showing, that's my just concern. So we'll move on from there.
All right.
So. All right, there was my conversation with Gabe Camarillo. Coming up next, before we hand you off to the Rich Eisen show, what I want to do, I'm gonna talk about the Major League Baseball salary cap and one of the projected wants from the league and owners in what that salary cap could look like. But I'm also going to give you a caveat to that, and it involves the Los Angeles Dodgers. Take a break. We'll be back. You're listening to the Valley Rise Show with Gonzo on your local sports leader. The Valley Rise Show with Gonzo on your local sports leader. Before I hand you off, before I let you go to the Rich Eisen show that's coming up here at 9 a.m., according to some people and seeing a couple of the reports, it is looking like MLB owners are reportedly proposing a $240 to $245 million salary cap. And a $171.2 million, so $165 to $175 million payroll floor beginning in 2027. This is going to become a really ugly fight. And so because of that, I also wanted to talk about some of the key variables to this. So the Los Angeles Dodgers, for those of you that know, I think a lot of you know this now, but if you don't, that's okay. We're gonna tell you. We're gonna tell you now, and if you do, hey, just correct me in your car if I'm wrong. So the Dodgers have an $8.4 billion TV contract, and that TV contract obviously approved settlement and all these things. Now, originally, when Frank McCourt was selling the team, he had struck a deal of $3 billion with Fox. Well, McCourt sued in bankruptcy court, and the court agreed that MLB's revenue share, 34%, would be based on the $3 billion figure, regardless of whether the other figure ever becomes bigger. That is all the way through to the 2030s. So the exception continues through 2039. So the Dodgers receive approximately $320 million annually from the local TV deal with Sportsnet LA, with about $100 million of that exempt from revenue sharing under their bankruptcy exception. Now, you would hear that and begin to think, oh my goodness, the Dodgers are keeping $100 million to themselves. Yes, that is partially true, and that is part of which the Dodgers have a little bit extra. Now, I was one that was a believer in that the Dodgers were wrong in this. That the Dodgers were just overly taking advantage of this. The more and more I look at this, the more and more I am with Dodger fans on the fact that, hey, your team can do it too. And it's why the deal that the Yankees have with the YES Network is so different. YES Network and Comcast reached an agreement in early 2026 with the regional sports network staying on Comcast. The deal extends through 2027. The Yankees' parent company reached a $2.6 billion equity investment deal with Apollo Sports Capital, which will be used for debt refinancing related to the Yankees' properties, including YES Network, AC Milan, New York City FC, and Legends Hospitality. Now the focus is turning a little bit to streaming. And so for those of you that don't know how the revenue sharing works, is national revenue sources like contracts with Fox, ESPN, TBS, they are already split evenly among all 30 teams. But local revenue, ticket sales, concessions, local sponsorship, local media deals, it's what goes into the revenue sharing pool. So the Dodgers paid about $175 million towards revenue sharing in 2025. They will pay more than $200 million in 2026. And that is roughly twice what the Yankees and Red Sox pay, and the gap is pretty big. Now, there is a loophole. Teams like the Yankees and Red Sox, who own large stakes in their regional sports networks, allowing revenues earned from those regional sports networks to fall outside of their Major League Baseball revenue sharing formula by being able to avoid paying into it with the thought of it saying, hey, profit versus revenue and what that looks like. So the Dodgers paid $169 million last year. The Yankees paid $62 million. The Mets paid $92 million, and the Phillies paid $56 million. Half of that, $403 million in luxury tax, went directly into the revenue share that was then split. The teams that do take from the revenue share are the Arizona Diamondbacks, the Colorado Rockies, the Tampa Bay Rays, the Pittsburgh Pirates, the Cleveland Guardians, the Houston Astros, the San Diego Padres estimated annual receiving about $20 to $30 million because of them being a mid-market team struggling with attendance and local revenue. The Mariners are receiving money. The Minnesota Twins are receiving money. The Texas Rangers are receiving money. Other teams also receiving money are the Reds, White Sox, Athletics, Brewers, and Royals. Those are all the teams taking money, not putting in into the revenue sharing. So, hey, once again, do we need a cap to go along with the floor? Or do we just need to reconfigure everything and to really look at this and say, are the Dodgers taking advantage of a system that was placed? Or are the small market teams the ones that are taking advantage of a system that was put in place? That's the question that I think you are going to have to answer, and that is going to be a really tough answer when baseball comes to an end in October and we go very straight into a lockout. And that's going to be the nuance of the conversation when it comes to the salary cap, and if there even is going to be a salary cap. A big thank you to all of you for joining us, for taking the time to be here. Coming up next, it's the Rich Eisen Show. Then, coming up at 2 o'clock, it's Sportsline, the Bulldog Hour with the man Tony D. And at 3 o'clock, it is Behind the Bench with Phil Bonatti. Appreciate you for being here, being part of the discussion. I'll talk to you mañana. You've been listening to the Valley Rise Show with Gonzo. Until next time.
It's the Valley Rise Show with Gonzo on ESPN Fresno.